Welcome in. It's great to have you joining us today. We are about to embark on a deep dive that honestly, it fundamentally rewired how I look at businesses.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It really is. It changes how you look at the stock market and really the way the whole modern economy organizes itself. We're digging into a truly fascinating mental model today.
Right, from Jocelyn Dubé's Averaging Up series.
Exactly. Specifically, a larger project in there called The Infinite Investor. And to set the stage for you, there's this famous quote from the legendary mutual fund manager Peter Lynch.
Oh, yeah, from One Up on Wall Street.
Right. He ran the Fidelity Magellan Fund in the 80s, generated just astronomical returns. And he wrote this line. He said, "When somebody says any idiot could run this joint, that's a plus as far as I'm concerned, because sooner or later, any idiot probably is going to be running it."
It's such a great quote. It gets a lot of play because it taps into this very cynical truth about corporate bureaucracy, you
Yeah.
know. But Lynch was looking at this primarily as a form of defense. He spent his days analyzing thousands of companies, and he recognized that management risk, like the risk of a CEO making a catastrophic capital allocation decision, that was one of the easiest ways to lose money.
Just a totally unforced error.
Exactly. So finding an idiot-proof business was a way to build a fortress around its capital. It was a shield against human error.
But the averaging up framework, it takes that defensive observation and it flips it completely on its head.
Right, it turns it into the ultimate structural offense.
Yeah, by introducing this concept called convergence. And convergence asks a much more radical question. It asks, what if the identity, the skill, the daily decisions of the person running the business, what if they aren't just something you protect against? What if they are structurally irrelevant to the company's growth?
Structurally irrelevant, which, I mean, that flies in the face of almost everything we're taught about business.
It really does. If you open any financial newspaper, the entire narrative is built around the hero CEO.
The visionary.
Right. The visionary who turns the company around, the genius navigating macroeconomic headwinds. But this framework suggests we need to completely abandon that paradigm.
We do. And over the next hour or so, we're going to borrow concepts from physics and chemistry to map how capital naturally flows.
We're going to look at why Charlie Munger had this deep, visceral hatred for a theoretical backyard.
That's a great concept.
It really is. And we'll eventually get to why the absolute pinnacle of investing and maybe business strategy itself is to evolve into what the text calls a mountain guide, someone whose primary job is to do absolutely nothing.
To really grasp that shift from Lynch's defense to Dubé's offense, we have to look at where the growth is actually coming from.
Okay, let's unpack that.
So in a standard business, even a very good one, management has to pull levers. They have to launch new products, they enter new markets, they figure out how to cut costs.
They're manufacturing the growth.
Exactly. But convergence introduces us to a business entity where the growth doesn't come from inside the building at all.
It comes from the outside. Right. The growth is generated by massive global structural forces entirely outside the company's control. The forces delivering the revenue are simply not under the CEO's command.
If we ground this in a real-world example from the sources, the ultimate illustration here is Visa.
Oh, Visa's the perfect example.
Let's run a thought experiment. Let's say we remove Visa's entire executive team. The CEO, the CFO, the board of directors, they all get locked out of the building for a year.
Just zero management.
Zero. No strategic offsites, no visionary leadership, no aggressive marketing campaigns. What actually happens to the underlying business?
Nothing bad.
Right. Do global governments suddenly abandon their push toward tax compliance and cashless societies? Do retail banks stop trying to eliminate the massive overhead costs of handling physical paper cash?
Of course not.
Or think about your own life. Do you suddenly stop tapping your phone at the grocery store? No, the answer is obvious. The digitalization of payments just continues without a single hiccup. The toll collects, the cash flows expand, and they do so regardless of who occupies the corner office in San Francisco.
That's the core of it. The framework makes this point incredibly stark. Visa does not pay for the digitalization of payments. They don't fund the global shift away from cash.
The rest of the world builds that growth for them entirely for free.
Entirely for free. And we see the exact same structural phenomenon with another company highlighted in the text, which is MSCI.
MSCI is a fascinating one. They operate deep in the financial plumbing.
For anyone not in the weeds on this, MSCI stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International, though they're an independent company now. They build and maintain stock market indices.
Right. So if an investor buys a massive passive ETF from BlackRock or Vanguard that tracks global equities, It is very likely tracking an MSCI index.
And if we apply that same thought experiment to them removing their management for a year, does the multi-trillion-dollar secular shift from active mutual funds to passive ETFs suddenly halt? Do pension funds stop benchmarking their performance? The reality is the royalty that MSCI collects accumulates entirely independently of their executives.
Which is a profound realization when you think about the pressure it relieves. MSCI charges a tiny fee, measured in basis points, on the massive pools of capital tracking their indices.
As more money flows into passive vehicles globally, a trend driven by investor awareness of fees, right, not by MSCI's marketing department, MSCI's revenue just grows.
If a CEO needs to be a hero, if a company's survival and growth are entirely dependent on the flawless execution and brilliance of its management team, the underlying structure of that business is actually highly vulnerable.
That is such a key point. A convergent business doesn't need a hero. It just needs the management to not actively sabotage the structural forces driving the growth.
Right. Just don't get in the way.
I do want to push back on that slightly, though, just acting as a proxy for the skeptical listener right now.
Sure.
Is Visa truly structurally secure? We hear about disruption constantly. What about crypto? What about the Federal Reserve launching FedNow, their own instant payment system? Or Apple Pay? Doesn't the idiot-proof narrative fall apart if a new technology just bypasses the toll booth entirely?
That is the exact right question to ask, and it gets to the heart of why convergence is so powerful. Let's look at those threats. Apple Pay, for instance. It feels like a disruptor.
It definitely does when you use it.
But if you look under the hood, Apple Pay is simply a beautiful user interface built on top of the existing Visa and MasterCard rails. Apple didn't bypass the toll booth. They just made it easier for you to drive through it.
Okay, that makes sense. What about crypto?
With crypto, the structural barrier is volatility and settlement speed at the merchant level. A coffee shop needs to know the exact fiat value of the transaction instantly to manage their margins. They can't wait for a blockchain to clear or for the price of Bitcoin to fluctuate. Regarding government systems like FedNow, they are generally focused on bank-to-bank clearing. Not at the incredibly complex, fraud-laden consumer-merchant dispute resolution network that Visa has spent 60 years building.
Ah, I see.
The structural moat isn't just technology. It's the millions of interconnected, multi-party relationships. Bypassing it requires coordinating a simultaneous global behavioral shift among banks, merchants, and consumers.
So the structure is much deeper than just the software code.
Exactly.
To really understand how these structures form and why capital naturally flows toward them, the averaging up framework borrows three concepts from the physical sciences.
This is where the mental model really solidifies.
Okay, let's unpack these. The three concepts are the gradient, distillation, and convergence. Let's start with the first one, the gradient. In physics, a gradient is essentially a slope.
Right. It's the path of steepest change that compels movement, like water flowing down a mountain.
In nature, flows always descend the gradient. Heat moves from a hot environment to a cold one. Molecules diffuse from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration.
And the crucial distinction here is that nothing chooses to descend. The water doesn't have a strategy meeting to decide to flow downhill.
No offsites for the water.
Exactly. The topography itself compels the movement. The text refers to this using the French term passage obligé, an obligatory passage. The physics of the system permits no other direction.
When applied to investing, the framework argues that capital has its own natural gravity.
Yes. Capital wants to find the path of least resistance. It naturally flows down a gradient from businesses that have a very expensive cost of growth to businesses that have free growth.
Capital descends the slope not necessarily because an active fund manager had a brilliant flash of insight, but by the relentless pull of the economic terrain.
It migrates away from places where a dollar of retained earnings generates a low return and moves toward places where a dollar of retained earnings generates an infinite return because the growth doesn't require capital at all.
Which brings us to the second law of this capital physics distillation. If the gradient is the slope, distillation is the process occurring as you travel down it.
Right. In chemistry, distillation is a purification process. You apply heat to a complex mixture. The heaviest, most sluggish elements remain at the bottom of the flask, while the lightest, purest essence vaporizes, rises to the top, and is collected.
In Dubé's framework, distillation is what happens to an investor's portfolio as it descends the capital gradient over time. Let's define what those heavy elements are in a financial context.
The framework categorizes businesses into tiers. Tier 3 businesses are the heavy elements. Think of capital-intensive industries, airlines, automotive manufacturers, heavy industrials.
Traditional retail.
Yeah, traditional retail. They might be decent businesses at the right price, but they require massive amounts of cash just to maintain their current position, let alone grow.
Then you have tier two.
Tier two might be great consumer brands. They have pricing power, but they still need to build factories and manage physical supply chains.
And then the pure essence at the top of the flask.
The tier one businesses. These are the information toll booths.
The text provides this stunning real-world example of this distillation process in action by looking at the portfolio of activist investor Chris Hahn and his TCI fund.
It's an incredible case study.
Over the course of just three quarters, $53.6 billion of Hahn's capital migrated. It was distillation happening in real time.
He actively eliminated the tier three capital-heavy businesses from his portfolio. The heavy elements fell away.
What remained the purified essence were those tier one information toll booths, companies like Visa, S&P Global, Moody's, and MSCI. They ended up making up 84% of his capital across his top five positions.
That level of concentration is wild, but it makes perfect sense when you view it through the lens of distillation. It wasn't a failure to diversify. It was the portfolio mathematically purifying itself as it followed the gradient to its logical endpoint.
And that endpoint is the third physical concept, convergence.
In fluid dynamics or evolutionary biology, convergence is when independent flows or traits concentrate at a single specific point.
Think of a river delta.
Right, the topography funnels countless independent tributaries toward the exact same outlet into the ocean.
Or look at evolutionary biology, where completely unrelated species develop identical solutions to the same environmental pressure. The structure of the eye evolved independently in dozens of different lineages, from mammals to cephalopods, because the physics of light only allows for a few optimal designs.
In investing, convergence is the recognition that certain rare businesses sit perfectly at structural convergence points. These are locations in the economic landscape where multiple, completely independent secular trends flow toward the exact same toll booth. Let's map out the tributaries feeding the Visa Delta, because it perfectly illustrates this. There are four distinct, powerful gradients funneling directly into their network.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, you have governments. They want to stamp out the black market and ensure tax compliance, so they enact policies pushing toward cashless economies. Right, they want a paper trail.
Exactly. Second, banks. The infrastructure required to handle physical cash, the armored trucks, the massive vaults, the bank tellers, the insurance, it's incredibly expensive. Their gradient pushes them to issue digital cards.
Cash is a massive cost center for a bank.
Huge. Third, consumers. We are inherently lazy. We want the convenience of tapping a phone rather than counting out coins.
Nobody wants to carry change.
No one. And fourth, merchants. They are downstream of consumer demand. If we want to pay digitally, they have to install the terminal to accept it.
Four independent rivers. Four entirely different slopes. The government in Europe passing a tax law doesn't care about a local bank's armored truck costs in Chicago, and the consumer capping their phone doesn't care about either of them.
Yet all four of these massive global forces are converging on a single point, Visa's toll booth.
Visa didn't engineer all four of these societal shifts. They sit at the geographic center of the topography where the water naturally collects.
But if this convergence is so massive, and frankly so obvious once you lay it out like that, why doesn't the market price it perfectly?
That's the billion-dollar question. The text points out that convergence is essentially invisible. And because it's invisible, the market consistently underestimates the terminal value of these businesses.
We have to look at behavioral finance here. Human beings, and by extension financial markets, are hardwired to notice acute, visible disruption.
We notice a loud, aggressive technological launch. We notice when a competitor slashes prices and margins compress. We react to noise.
But convergence doesn't issue a press release. It is entirely silent.
As the text puts it, the river widens imperceptibly. The toll collects automatically.
No one rings a bell on Wall Street when another $1 billion of everyday mundane transactions subtly shifts from physical cash to a digital rail over the course of a quarter. It just happens continuously.
That silent structural widening is its greatest camouflage.
We get so distracted by the flashy IPOs and the AI product demos that we ignore the silent river getting deeper.
To really grasp the magnitude of these convergent businesses, we need to trace how the infinite investor categorizes them. The framework originally grouped companies into three buckets based on the timing and duration of their cash flows.
This is foundational to getting to the ultimate insight.
Yeah, so the original taxonomy started with A companies. These are short-duration businesses. Think of a mature consumer staple like Coca-Cola or a massive retailer like Walmart.
They generate immense amounts of cash right now, today.
Right. They are stalwarts. They are highly predictable, but they generally lack a massive structural runway for future exponential growth. They are cash machines in the present, returning that cash via dividends or buybacks.
Then you have the B companies. These are the long-duration, hyper-growth businesses. Think of an early-stage sauce company.
They take every single penny they generate, and usually a lot of venture capital on top of it, and aggressively reinvest it into building out their future runway.
They are entirely focused on tomorrow. They are building the road, but they aren't collecting a meaningful toll yet.
And historically, the holy grail for an investor was finding a dual-duration company. These are the rare beasts that possess both engines simultaneously.
The classic example is Amazon or Berkshire Hathaway.
Exactly. They possess the A massive predictable cash generation today from their core businesses. And D, they possess the B massive ongoing highly effective investment into a long-term growth runway. They manage to do both at the same time.
But the Averaging Up series introduces a critical new lens to this taxonomy. They look at that elite group of dual duration companies and ask a piercing question: what is the actual cost of that B?
How much blood, sweat, and capital does that future growth actually cost to build and maintain?
This is the pivot point of the whole theory. Here's where it gets really interesting. Some dual-duration companies build their B, their growth engine, deliberately and at immense expense.
They execute complex mergers. They fund massive R&D departments. They build sprawling physical logistics networks.
But others, and this is the revelation, receive their B for absolutely free. It is delivered to them by those external structural forces we just mapped out.
Distinguishing between a growth engine that is actively purchased versus one that is structurally given for free, it reveals a completely new subspecies of business.
The text calls this subspecies the free surfer. A free surfer is a dual-duration business where the growth engine, the B, costs absolutely nothing.
It is convergence incarnated.
The formula used is A times B. A is the toll, the existing entrenched network. B is a force of nature, like the digitalization of money or the rise of passive indexing.
The free surfer doesn't build the wave. It doesn't steer the waves. It just sits on the board and rides it.
The framework identifies the five free surfers that perfectly embody this: Visa, MasterCard, S&P Global, Moody's, and MSCI. They are all information toll booths with zero-cost growth riding irreversible secular waves.
The text even breaks them down further. You have the classic free surfers like the payment networks, you have the resilient model like Moody's, and the hybrid model like S&P Global, which collects a dual toll.
Let's unpack the mechanics of S&P Global, because the way they collect their toll is structurally brilliant.
It really is.
S&P Global didn't create the global credit economy. But if a corporate treasurer at a Fortune 500 company wants to issue $1 billion in bonds to build a new factory, they're structurally forced to get a credit rating from at least two of the major agencies, usually S&P and Moody's.
Why? Because government regulators mandate it for certain types of debt.
And more importantly, institutional investors, the mutual funds and pensions actually buying the bonds, demand it as part of their own compliance frameworks.
The corporate treasurer has no choice. The fee paid to S&P Global is a negligible fraction of the capital being raised, making it an absolute no-brainer. And yet, it represents incredibly high margin revenue for S&P.
Every dollar of debt issued globally pays a toll. The overall growth of global debt issuance is S&P's B. And S&P doesn't spend a dime to convince the world to issue more debt.
The macroeconomic structure of the world just does it, and they collect the toll.
To really drive home the difference between a business that buys its growth and a free surfer that gets it for free, the text offers a brilliant contrast between two types of dual duration models: mechanical duality versus natural duality.
And to illustrate mechanical duality, it looks at arguably the most respected company in American history, Berkshire Hathaway.
Berkshire Hathaway is the most magnificent mechanical duality ever constructed. Its A is its existing operations, the massive insurance float, the BNSF Railway, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, the manufacturing subsidiaries.
Its B is its growth engine, which is driven entirely by capital allocation, taking the cash generated by A and acquiring new businesses or public equities to compound the capital.
It is an incredible machine, but that B is extraordinarily expensive. And the cost isn't just financial. It's a massive cost in human capital, attention, and execution risk.
Let's quickly define insurance float for context. When you buy car insurance from GEICO, which Berkshire owns, you pay your premium up front. Geico holds that money sometimes for years before they have to pay it out in claims.
That pool of held money is the float.
Right. Warren Buffett's genius was using that float, essentially a massive zero-interest loan from policyholders, to buy other businesses. But deploying that float requires human genius.
Exactly. To illustrate this human cost, the author analyzes a hypothetical February 2026 annual letter from Greg Abel, the man tapped to succeed Warren Buffett as CEO.
In this letter, Abel uses phrases like intentionally designed to allocate capital rationally and efficiently.
If we deconstruct those words, they reveal the hidden cost. Intentionally designed means it is a human creation requiring constant, vigilant upkeep.
Allocate capital rationally means a human being must make thousands of correct, high-stakes decisions under immense pressure.
Think about the sheer terror of Abel's job. The letter outlines his responsibilities: evaluate massive industrial opportunities, understand diverse businesses deeply, act as the ultimate chief risk officer, ensure insurance is priced correctly across global catastrophes, and know exactly when to walk away from a deal.
These are acts of immense judgment. He is managing a tentacular empire of energy grids, freight trains, insurance conglomerates, and retail chains.
The attention cost is staggering. The system requires a central intelligence that is perfectly awake, engaged, and disciplined. If Abel makes a bad call on a $15 billion acquisition, the mechanical duality stalls.
Now, contrast that grueling mechanical duality with the natural duality of Visa. If we were to read an annual letter from the CEO of Visa, it wouldn't need to outline a complex framework for evaluating diverse industrial acquisitions.
Visa doesn't need to scour the earth evaluating distressed asset opportunities.
The opportunities structurally flow to Visa. The wave of digitalization arrives at their servers every single millisecond, whether the CEO is awake, asleep, or playing golf.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the cost of B completely dictates the CEO's job description.
Yes. Greg Abel's job at Berkshire requires active, relentless, generational brilliance. He has to be extraordinary just to keep the machine compounding.
But what is the job of the CEO of Visa? According to the framework, the CEO of a free surfer has one primary directive: do not interfere.
That is the ultimate realization of convergence. Visa is the blueprint. The external forces, digitalization, regulation, consumer convenience, they're doing all the heavy lifting.
The CEO's role is not to direct these massive global currents. It is to avoid doing anything incredibly stupid that would impede the flow of the river.
Don't alienate the issuing banks. Don't trigger an antitrust hammer from the government. Just maintain the toll booth.
Which brings us right back to Peter Lynch's original quote. An idiot couldn't destroy Visa because even an idiot cannot reverse the structural, worldwide digitalization of the global economy.
The wave is simply stronger than any executive standing on the shore trying to push it back.
This perfectly tees up one of the most conceptually beautiful parts of this deep dive. We are going to talk about Charlie Munger's backyard.
To understand the backyard, we need to introduce a man named John Anderson. Anderson was a friend of Munger's, and he ran a very successful used construction equipment business.
Successful is the operative word, but with a massive asterisk. On paper, on the income statement, Anderson's business was highly profitable. Every year, he made money.
But there was a structural trap. Every year, that profit didn't end up in Anderson's pocket as liquid cash. It physically sat in his backyard in the form of newly purchased bulldozers, excavators, and spare parts.
In order to stay in business, maintain his market share, and offset the depreciation of his heavy machinery, he was forced to reinvest essentially every dollar he earned right back into more equipment.
Munger looked at this dynamic and famously stated, "We hate that kind of a business."
Because it's a treadmill disguised as a compounder, the business was technically growing, the B was real, but it was agonizingly expensive. Every dollar of profit was recycled into the cost of just staying in place.
Anderson was bleeding cash to fund his own existence.
So the text applies one of Munger's most famous mental models to this problem, inversion. Munger always advised, "Tell me where I'm going to die so I don't go there."
If Anderson's equipment yard represents the heavy, expensive cost of B, the inversion principle demands that we run as far away from that backyard as possible. We must find businesses where the growth costs less.
And if we follow the gradient of that inversion, we can actually trace Munger and Buffett's historical evolution as investors.
In the early days, they bought textile mills and retail stores, heavy backyards. Then they discovered See's Candies.
C's had a much lighter backyard. It required some capital for stores and kitchens, but its massive pricing power meant it generated far more cash than it needed to retain.
Then they moved to Coca-Cola, an even lighter backyard. Coke produces the syrup and the brand, but they let the independent bottlers take the massive capital hit of building the bottling plants and buying the delivery trucks.
Coke was capable of global, exponential growth with relatively minimal capital reinvestment. They were walking down the gradient, shedding capital intensity at each step.
But the text takes us to the absolute logical limit of the inversion process. It states, if you invert the backyard completely, you get Visa.
A free surfer like Visa has a completely empty backyard. Because they don't pay for their own growth, every dollar of net income leaves the business as pure, unadulterated free cash flow.
There is literally nothing to reinvest in. They don't build bank branches. They don't manufacture the plastic cards. They don't build the merchant terminals.
The rest of the world builds out the physical infrastructure of their growth for free. So Anderson's Equipment Yard isn't just a bad business. It's the literal mathematical inverse of Visa.
That completely changes how you look at a balance sheet.
There is a phenomenal anecdote in the text from the 2018 Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting that encapsulates this. An 8-year-old girl stood up to the microphone and asked Warren Buffett a remarkably sharp question.
She basically asked why Berkshire had moved away from capital-efficient businesses like Coca-Cola and See's Candies and started buying capital-heavy Tier 3 businesses like the BNSF Railroad.
Munger took the microphone, and his answer was incredibly revealing. He looked at the girl and said, she basically wants her royalty on the other fellow's sales. And of course, that's a very good model.
A royalty on the other fellow's sales. That is convergence, defined in 8 words.
Visa doesn't create the sale. They collect a royalty because the structure of the financial system dictates that the sale must pass through their network.
S&P Global doesn't issue the debt. They collect a royalty on the corporate treasurer's necessity. The royalty isn't earned by sweat or internal innovation. It is extracted purely by structural position.
Once you understand this, the obvious next question is, what do you actually do with this information? The framework transitions from the mechanics of identifying these companies to the philosophy of holding them.
And to do this, it introduces a striking metaphor, the porcelain vase.
Imagine a portfolio that has finally reached its ultimate optimized form after years of distillation. It sits on a shelf like a priceless, delicate porcelain vase.
It is complete. It requires absolutely no maintenance, no tweaking, no active improvement.
The only way that a vase breaks is if the owner gets bored, anxious, or overconfident, picks it up, and accidentally drops it.
Every time you tinker with a perfectly convergent portfolio, every time you rebalance for the sake of feeling active or trade in and out to capture a few percentage points of perceived value, you are picking up the vase.
And you are mathematically risking dropping it. We need to anchor this metaphor in hard financial reality because it sounds poetic, but it's based on brutal math.
The text brings in the landmark research of Professor Hendrik Bessembinder. He studied the entire U.S. stock market from 1926 to the present day.
His findings shatter the way most people view the market. He discovered that only 4% of all listed stocks account for the entirety of net wealth creation in the equity market over the risk-free rate.
The other 96% of stocks, collectively, merely match the return of treasury bills.
This is the mathematical reality of a power law or a fat-tail distribution. The stock market is not a normal bell curve where most companies do okay, a few do terribly, and a few do great.
The vast, overwhelming majority of public companies destroy value or tread water. A tiny, microscopic fraction of companies generate all the excess returns.
The core argument of the averaging up framework is that convergent businesses, these free surfers, are the fat tail. They are the 4%.
If you are holding the 4%, touching it is mathematical suicide. Think about the drag of an active portfolio. Every time you sell a great company to buy a mediocre one because it looks cheap, you incur trading fees.
You suffer the bid-ask spread slippage.
And most importantly, you trigger massive capital gains taxes, bleeding capital out of your compounding machine to pay the government.
The framework examines three legendary investors who all arrived at this exact same conclusion, this state of optimal inactivity, but they took three entirely different paths to get there.
Let's dedicate some time to each of them because their divergent paths to the same destination are fascinating. First, you have Nick Sleep, who ran the Nomad Investment Partnership.
Sleep arrived at the shelf via deep structural conviction.
Right. He developed a concept called scale economics shared. He did incredibly deep research into just a few companies, most notably Costco and Amazon.
He realized that as they grew, they didn't keep the excess profit. They gave it back to the consumer in the form of lower prices, which drove more volume, which drove more scale in a perpetual motion machine.
Once he understood that architecture perfectly, he bought them, essentially closed his mind to new ideas, and stopped trading entirely. His conviction in the business model led directly to his inactivity.
Then you have Charlie Munger. His path to the shelf was driven by inversion and psychology.
Munger was obsessed with avoiding human stupidity. He systematically eliminated everything he hated in investing. Complexity, high leverage, businesses with heavy backyards, management teams he couldn't trust.
He just kept stripping away the bad until he was left with just a tiny handful of positions that he felt were truly bulletproof.
Munger famously said, "Three will suffice. Hell, one will suffice if you do it right." His psychological aversion to making unforced errors led him to inactivity.
And finally, you have Chris Hahn. He arrived at the shelf via the gradient itself. Hahn manages institutional capital, which usually demands constant activity, hedging, and trading.
But Hahn literally followed the distillation process. He systematically sold off the heavy backyards in his portfolio, the aerospace, the railways, the tier three companies, and let his capital flow down the slope until 84% of it pooled in toll booths like Visa and S&P Global.
He recognized that once the capital reached the lowest cost of growth, moving it again would defy the laws of physics. The structural distillation led him to inactivity.
Nick Slip, Charlie Munger, and Chris Hahn. Three radically different temperaments. They didn't share a unified playbook or a group chat.
Yet the underlying structure of capital physics, the reality of the power law and convergence, led all three of these brilliant minds to the exact same rational destination. Inactivity.
When the forces converge and the business compounds without requiring capital decisions, doing nothing isn't a sign of laziness. It is the most highly optimized, mathematically sound action possible.
Doing something would just chip the vase.
This brings us to the final evolution of the investor, transitioning from what the framework calls the racer to the mountain guide.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
In the early part of an investing career, the racer phase action is fundamentally required. You are building the portfolio, researching, sizing positions, learning the mechanics of the market. Your active decisions generate your early returns.
But if you follow the gradient, you eventually cross a critical threshold. You cross a line where your time becomes vastly more valuable than the marginal benefit of your next trade.
You realize the portfolio's structural compounding is infinitely more powerful than any new active decision you could make.
That is when you evolve into the mountain guide. And what does the mountain guide do?
They only do one thing. They sit quietly on the mountain and watch for avalanches.
They don't try to make the snow fall faster. They don't run around rearranging the rocks. They just watch the structural landscape.
They ask themselves macro questions. Are the secular forces of digitalization still intact? Has a massive new antitrust regulation fundamentally broken the toll booth?
They might ask these fundamental questions maybe once a year. The rest of the time, they simply wait.
Waiting is incredibly difficult for highly intelligent type A individuals. Think about a market panic like March 2020. The psychological urge to do something, to sell, to hedge, to protect the portfolio, it's overwhelming.
But the mountain guide recognizes that the structural forces, like the shift to passive indexing, don't disappear during a pandemic. As Munger beautifully put it, the big money is not in the buying and selling, but in the waiting.
And this leads to the philosophical climax of the entire text. It brings in a quote from Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. The Tao does nothing, yet nothing is left undone.
This isn't just Eastern mysticism tacked onto a finance theory. It is the perfect, literal description of a convergent business and the guy who holds it.
The business does nothing to create the forces driving its growth, yet its growth is completely assured. The mountain guy does nothing to actively manage the portfolio, yet the wealth compounding is fully realized.
Doing nothing in this specific context is not apathy. It is the ultimate disciplined recognition of structural convergence.
It is the hardest thing for an active mind to achieve, but it is mathematically the most rewarding state to inhabit.
What a journey. From Peter Lynch's defensive, idiot-proof business to the profound stillness of Lao Tzu. Let's do a quick recap of the massive ground we just covered.
We started with the realization that the best businesses make management structurally irrelevant.
We mapped the physics of capital down the gradient, watching the heavy backyards get eliminated through distillation until the capital pooled at the ultimate destination convergence.
We discovered the free surfer, a business that rides massive secular waves and gets its growth for absolutely free,
We emptied Charlie Munger's backyard, placed our delicate porcelain vase safely on the shelf, and finally learned to sit quietly like the mountain guide, just watching for avalanches.
It is a remarkable mental model that shifts your entire perspective. Before we go, I want to leave everyone with a thought to chew on, an extrapolation of everything we've discussed today, but applied completely outside the stock market.
I love this.
Think about your own human capital. Think about your career, your business, or your specific skill set. Are you currently operating like John Anderson's equipment yard?
Are you on a treadmill, forced to reinvest your own blood, sweat, tears, and late nights just to stay relevant and keep your place in the hierarchy?
Or is it possible to position your human capital at a personal convergence point? What would your career look like if you found your own empty backyard, a place where massive, structural, societal forces are doing the heavy lifting for you, pushing you forward?
And your only job is simply to not interfere with your own compounding success. Find your empty backyard. That is such a powerful lens for looking at your own life. I want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. As a reminder, this entire framework, from the Free Surfers to the Mountain Guide, comes from the Averaging Up series and the larger project, The Infinite Investor by Jocelyn Dubé. It is truly essential reading. Keep exploring those convergence points in your own life, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.